Kiss performing in their New York for their final show. The passing of the legendary James Earl Jones. Deadpool and Wolverine finally getting the rematch they deserve. These pop culture milestones all occurred over the last 11 months since we last did a podcast. And a lot can change in a year. In today's climate, that might be an understatement. And here at the Wing, we've excelled through another fiscal year, conducted several deployments, and even received a new Wing Commander, Colonel Byron Newell. So we thought, after a long break in the podcast battle space, we'd kick the comeback off with a banger. Harder than Harrison Butker. And if those of you who know me are wondering if I Googled that name, why yes. Yes, I did. Everyone, this is the Maniac Radio Show, episode 67, and I'm Master Sergeant Andy Sinclair. Next up, Colonel Byron Newell, 101st Air Refueling Wing Commander.
Are you and your wife excited for the Chiefs game coming up?
Absolutely. Yeah, it'll be the only one that we're going to in person this year, and quite frankly, the only one that we will have been to in person in quite some time, so we're excited.
Oh, that's cool. Well, I just saw something this morning about how there was something like a massive poll was taken on whether or not NFL fans believe Taylor Swift has kind of taken, like, become a. What's your take on that? How's that a?
Hey, she's a member of Chiefs Kingdom now, so we accept all. Okay. You know, it doesn't matter if you've been a member of Chiefs Kingdom for your entire life or you're brand new. You're a member of Chiefs Kingdom when you're a member of Chiefs Kingdom. So Taylor's welcome, just as anybody else is.
That's cool.
You know, they say that as time goes by, the years pass, that you don't remember specific things that people said or even necessarily things that people did, but what you remember is how they made you feel.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
It's
so
true.
I think it's the same way with sports teams. For me, I was a young man, just turned 18, went off to the East Coast to join the Navy. And it was before the days of the internet or the cable TV where you could watch whatever you wanted on demand streaming. And I missed, my home state and my friends and my family immensely. But if I saw the Royals or the Chiefs on TV, it was just the best feeling in the world. You know,
it'd bring you back.
It would take you back. And it was, I think for me, that early 90s experience of being on the East Coast away from home. And then when you see your sports teams, it's how it makes you feel. Mm-hmm. Right. So maybe that's just by association.
That's a good explanation. I guess I never thought about it that way. I just always assumed it was like a certain player. Maybe your family or your parents were big support, whatever. But I'm sure a lot of that is the case. But how it makes you feel, I guess, it's kind of like with certain movies. I'll watch certain films and be like, oh yeah, this reminds me of a different time in my life. Mm-hmm. And it's about the feeling. All right, sir. So, first question, sir, I want to talk about, and ask you about something you mentioned this morning in stand-up, which was we have recently been announced as the KC-46 Final Seven. What does that mean for us? And what does that mean for you?
Well, I'll just have to admit quite frankly that, for anybody who's a fan of the boys, being a member of the Seven just makes me laugh.
That is funny.
But so they've narrowed down the KC-135 bases across the country to seven that are being considered to be the next home of the KC-46 Pegasus, which is, of course, our next generation tanker that is actively replacing the KC-135. Now, it will be decades before the KC-135 is fully replaced. And they're not all going to be replaced with KC-46s. We recently learned that the Air National Guard is making plans to operate the KC-135 out to the year 2060.
Wow.
It will be a 100-year airplane. That being said, so whether we are the next base to be given KC-46s or we're the second or the third or it's 10 years, however that plays out, we just have to be ready for it. So in the immediate future, they'll come and they'll do site surveys. When I say they, that's the National Guard Bureau, will come do site surveys at the seven candidate locations. That's what it is with the seven candidate locations. And after a vetting process that will take approximately a year, we expect a final decision to be announced publicly about a year from now. So it'll be next fall before we actually know the decision. And of course, years beyond that, as we do the construction on the base that's necessary to accommodate the KC-46, get the new airplanes, divest of our old ones, train our crews and our maintainers to operate the new airplane. And that's that conversion process is a very lengthy process. So this is really a strategic lookout quite a ways into the future, but this is the first step.
So needless to say, they, I mean, like probably most of the leadership that we have in place right now, if we were awarded, wouldn't even see it in, within their military career, or would they? I mean, that's the...
Well, I think that's, I won't see it.
Yeah, right.
Chief Niedorowski won't see it. Mm-hmm. Now, that being said, I think that you know, it's likely that the next wing commander after me very likely won't see it. But folks that, you know, are going to be here anywhere from 5 years and beyond, mm-hmm. I would say that that's the window. There'll probably actually be the KC-46 generation mm-hmm. if we actually are announced this go around. And that's just a swag. That's just a guess.
Is there just one more awarding, or is there...
They currently only have one more guard base to award KC-46s mm-hmm. with the current buy. By the current buy, I mean the current contract with Boeing to produce KC-46s only allows enough aircraft for one more location to be identified. So beyond this, there would have to be further contracting actions to continue purchasing more KC-46s.
Okay. I guess that makes more sense now that you explain it that way. I think it was always kind of like a... I was hearing certain things or reading certain things, and then, you know how it is. You read a few different articles or sure. from a few different leadership, you know, positions, and it's like, oh, okay. You know, kind of spinning off that original topic, is there any, like, just from an outsider's perspective, a non-flying perspective, you know, the way I look at it is, I see geographically, you know, we've been pitched this and it's been preached and embedded into us that geographically it makes sense that we had a new airframe type of thing. But, you know, is there any added value or disadvantage in your opinion to, you know, that we are so close to Pease and they already have it? I mean, how does that work?
That's a great question. And it has been part of the conversation. I think if you look at one side of it, certain folks would argue that, well, we already have KC-46 capability in this part of the country, so let's spread it out and put it somewhere different. The way I look at it is, if you're talking about the Midwest, you already have KC-46 capability there in droves because you have active duty McConnell Air Force Base, which will be completely converted to KC-46s before the Guard ever is. And then as far as regionally here, our proximity to the North Atlantic and the tanker tracks there and the significance for homeland defense and power projection that comes with anytime we surge into NATO or points east, whether it be the crisis right now going on in the Middle East with Gaza and Israel, whether it be the war in Ukraine, anything that requires that surge of American capability, having two guard bases in this region that operate the KC-46, in my opinion, and I share this opinion with many others, it really creates almost like a super wing of KC-46s up here, and it creates efficiencies of being able to support each other, be able to interfly, be able to, you know, we can move there and operate out of their location if something happens to this base or vice versa. And I don't see it as being a negative to have almost like a regional KC-46 capability being operated by the Air National Guard. It essentially creates an active duty equivalent capability in this region by spreading it amongst two Air National Guard bases.
That's pretty cool. I didn't even think about that, because it would be like, if we were awarded it, how many is it, like seven? Or
it'd
eight
be or eight aircraft eight? Currently. So we would go from the 10 aircraft we currently have down to eight KC-46s.
Mm-hmm. And how much does your standard active duty flying squadron have?
So I don't know if I can answer this 100% accurately. I should know this answer, but I believe the average squadron on active duty has 12 airplanes.
Oh, okay.
So Pease right now has 12 airplanes. We have eight. Mm. If we got the eight, there'd be 20 total in this region, and you'd essentially be creating a two squadron equivalent, essentially, capability here in the Northeast.
Wow, that's awesome. Yeah, like I said, I never even stopped to think about it that way. I was just looking at it from like a geographic standpoint, like what makes more sense, us or Mickey Tyson or whoever else.
Right.
Huh. That's cool.
Well, the geography of this region cannot be denied. And when you look at the height of the Cold War, this region had seven active duty mm-hmm. military airfields And we're now down to, in that same region, three Air National Guard facilities between us, Pease, and Burlington and Vermont. So we are by far the last outpost, so to speak, in the continental United States as far as any military installation or any military airfield capability. And with the curve of the earth, the Great Circle routes, that really, that proximity stretches all the way down into Africa and points east out towards India in terms of us being the closest location. So, yeah, it's just very geographically important, strategically important.
That's pretty cool. Yeah, that's good to know. And hopefully, and I'm sure the higher ups and the decision makers of this country understand that and see that as well, especially if you guys are pining for it and advocating for it. That's cool.
Pining for it. I like that word.
I don't know if that's the right word. I don't know if that's the right word, but
pining is the right word.
I guess what
we'll
is
go
that,
with it.
What does pining even mean? Does that mean like yearning?
Yearning.
I don't know.
I need a
thesaurus. ChatGPT or the Jags. all right, sir. So what's going on with the DEOC survey? I see a lot of email traffic about that this week.
Yeah, so everyone knows what the DEOC survey is, and we don't need to spend a lot of time talking about that, but I'm glad you mentioned it because I think a lot of people have survey fatigue. A lot of people have been doing this for years and perhaps don't see the value in it. But I appreciate the chance to make a plug from a commander's perspective on the importance of it. You have to establish so many different ways of communicating with an organization in order to really get the full picture of your culture and what's going on within an organization. Whether it's direct conversations, emails, social media, but then also having that anonymous capability for every airman in the wing to have that forum where they can just put their honest opinions and have it not tied to themselves or their name in any way, shape, or form, and really just kind of everything they know or learn or have concerns about, and have that direct communication with the wing leadership. I've seen DX surveys over the years that I've been a commander be very effective at getting after some real problems because, people are honest with them. Now, the DX surveys, if you use it as a forum to rant or vent or just, personally attack individuals because of some grievance or some perceived grievance without really having a proposed solution to a problem. And that's a waste of your time. It's a waste of mine. But if you actually do the survey honestly and give constructive feedback and constructive criticism, it is a very valuable tool. And I will say this too, it's just so important that as many people as we can get to do the survey to give good qualitative data that we can actually analyze. Because if the only people doing the survey are the people who are not, upset or aggravated about something, that doesn't give you good data.
No.
In terms of, okay, is this a big enough issue for us to actually take action, or is this a few individuals who have grievances? And in an organization this size, you will always have individuals who have grievances, maybe rightfully so, wrongfully so. But at the end of the day, unless we have a good 50, 60, 70% completion rate on the survey, we're really just not getting good data. So if anyone's listening to this and has a chance to do the DEOC before we close it out on December 9th, I would appreciate it. Please take the time to do the survey. Now, we are, Andy, having some technical issues right now, so we're working through those, but I hope to have that resolved here in a few days.
What's the issue? Is it like a non-submission thing? Like, is it not going through?
It was a couple different issues. It was some people were getting a survey that didn't associate them with any particular unit, so we'd have no way to know if their responses were in medical group or maintenance group or ops group. And then the other issue was just incompatibility with some of the personal devices that people were using to do the survey, and that's being worked through as well.
Oh, okay. So my next question, you've already answered it, but so December 9th, that is the deadline.
Yeah, so our goal was to get it open before the October drill and leave it open until after the December drill so that the full time period of the survey being open would encompass two full drill periods.
Okay. Add on to that, you said earlier grievances or grudges or would you as the top dog, as the commander of the wing, would you encourage listeners or participants in the DEOC survey to keep it respectful as if you were just talking to you in person? Would that be fair to say?
Respectful, yes, but I think that when you have an anonymous format, you can be a little bit more free-flowing in your thoughts than if it's an in-person conversation.
Right, so, me as a master sergeant, I'm not going to come in and complain to you to a full bird.
Use some profanity if you want. Get it out there. Use it as a stress release tool. Yeah. I don't care, but just try to identify real problems and propose some real solutions. I guess would be what I would ask.
I feel like that's 99% of the communication sometimes, is that people don't have effective COAs or tentative COAs in their mind. They want you to fix it. You're the boss, yeah. You fix it.
We just want change. We just want it to be different. Right. And that's a human, that's a very human quality. We're going through it. They're unhappy with the way it is. We want change. Mm-hmm. What do you want to change?
Right.
I think people have a hard time quantifying that sometimes.
Yeah, for sure. Is there anything else you want to add about the deoxer?
No, I don't think so. Okay. I think you get it there, Andy. Appreciate it.
All right.
Appreciate the chance to talk about it.
So what's, as far as recruiting goes, it seems like, was it 110 we hit last year?
Yeah, awesome. Yeah. The recruiting team hit 110 before the fiscal year closed out.
And that's cool.
It's a great number. You know, our goal every year was 100 until this last week when we changed it 101. To 101. That's... Our goal every year from now on is going to be 101 as far as new recruits. But I guess it's
good that we're not the 501st.
Yeah, well, some states, you know, talking to them, it depends on the size of your state.
That's
some,
true.
Some states actually have
that many that recruits.
Requirements, but we don't. We're a smaller state when it comes to the Guard, and 101, well, if we can keep that going and keep our retention. Remember, how many people you have to recruit is directly tied to your retention. Are people staying? Mm-hmm. You know, and how long do they stay? So they're both incredibly important. But my thoughts on recruiting are just to really emphasize to everybody that I can convey this to is, you know, recruiting is a command priority. It's a command prerogative. It is something that every single one of us in uniform should be thinking about as we go about our daily lives. It's not just those dedicated folks that we have actually assigned to recruiting, whose job it is to process the paperwork and plan the events and communicate with the public. But your job, public affairs, has a huge role in recruiting and how we present ourselves to the public, the messaging that we put out, how each of us conducts ourselves in the community on a day-to-day basis. You know, do you wear your uniform to high school sporting events every once in a while? You know, if not, why? Why don't you wear your uniform and strike up conversation with folks? It's, you know, all those things that at the end of the day, we really need to establish a culture where everyone is a recruiter. And I would challenge every single maniac out there, if you haven't personally walked somebody into the recruiting office in the course of your career out here, I challenge you to do that and make that one of your goals. To do that, you know, if not every couple of years, at least do it once.
Right. Yeah.
Get somebody in personally.
Right. And honestly, too, this kind of, in a way, in my mind, when I think about this, this kind of ties back to what we were just talking about with the DEOC survey. With so it, me as say I'm 18 years old or I'm 22 years old, fresh out of college, and I have no job, no plans, no nothing. And I've got a buddy who's been in the Guard, you know, as a maniac for X amount of years. If I learned that, you know, that their leadership takes the time to perform these surveys, these climate surveys, because they want to make change based off the lowest airman all the way up to whoever, that's kind of cool. You know, maybe I've never had a job that does that, you know, and so that it's things like that that we could talk about, and that getting that information out would, I feel like, motivate people to say, this is an organization that cares about my buddy or me or whoever, or my parents. And I want to be a part of that too. Like, that's awesome.
Yeah. That family environment, that family culture, something obviously very important to my predecessor, Colonel Gillis, who, you know, obviously spent his entire career here, and to him, this place is family in more ways than one. Mm-hmm. And that's absolutely true, but it goes so much beyond just that sense of family and that we pass it on from generation to generation, but that we have a sense of family in that we're part of the community. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we don't put up a wall and say, this is a best kept secret. No, this is a community asset. This is something that can get our best and our brightest young folks from the community into, you know, something that helps them serve at a national level as well, gives them that broad perspective. And, you know, there's so many people, Andy, that are just outside the gate that know that we're here, but don't know who we are or what we do. Hey, taxi by on their American Airlines flight, or you know, their Delta flight. Sorry, I won't, you know, try to play favorites for any particular airline. And they look out the window and they see these tankers sitting there. And, you know, I saw it in my old unit, same thing. You know, those C-130s there, that's cool. But do you know what they do, who they are? And most people don't understand the Guard. Mm-hmm. And they don't understand the opportunities in the Guard. and how, you know, you have to dispel those myths about what service in the Guard really is. And that's part of the biggest part of recruiting, I think, is just having those regular engagements with the community to dispel those myths.
Yeah. When you first joined the service, and you went to Annapolis, you were an academy graduate.
So I was.
So did you know what the Guard was?
Absolutely not.
Hadn't heard of it?
No, absolutely not. Had I heard of it? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Did I know what it was? No.
No.
No idea. I mean, I got my private pilot's license flying Cessnas at the same airport where the C-130s were being operated by the Guard. I was in the pattern with them. Mm-hmm. And in my mind, the Guard was something that you could do maybe possibly someday after you served on active duty. Mm-hmm. The notion of walking through the gate and being able to join the Guard on day one, nobody had that conversation with me.
Yeah.
You know, nobody talked to me about that. And I just think that's kind of tragic when we, I think the Guard is getting out of that bubble, right? I think we were kind of reclusive for a lot of years. Mm-hmm. We just were very consciously trying to get outside of that. Okay, we have our own little secret society here. And communicate more openly with the public.
Mm, yeah, absolutely. My dad says the same thing. When he joined active duty Air Force, he had no idea what the Guard was, and didn't know there was a Guard unit in Bangor, and grew up 45 minutes from here.
Right.
All he knew is that he wanted to join active and put on his wish list Loring Air Force Base and hope to get back to the state of Maine.
Right.
So
yeah.
So can we talk a little bit about commander focus, family readiness, and another 9/11 type? You've said this a lot in stand up, another 9/11 type event where we would be ready to, not to steal from General Roy, but he always used to like to say, ready to fight tonight type of thing.
Yeah. Fight tonight. Yeah. Where were you on 9/11?
I was in eighth grade, and I remember hearing about it and my English teacher rolling in the I don't know what they call it. The boob tube TVs and on the cart and
it's called a VCR, Andy.
Yeah, I can't even spell it.
It was probably a DVD player when you were in eighth grade.
Yeah, I think DVDs were just starting to come out, and but at home we had mostly VHSs, but when she brought it in and turned on the live news, and we and like I said, my dad was out here and was recalled. I didn't see him for 2 weeks, and he was a part of the comm squadron. My grandparents had to come down and stay with us. And at the time, I was old enough to know what it meant and the severity of it and the sadness. You could see it in adults' faces and their interpersonal communication skills. You could see it in the teachers and how worried they were. But, I was still a kid. I wasn't an adult yet. But
How many of the folks that are members of this wing right now were not even born, and how many were five?
Right.
Versus being in eighth grade.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
So I think that's what I'm getting at when I say, have we really truly prepared ourselves for that 9/11 type moment? Because the 9/11 type moment is when your world changes forever. Mm-hmm. The world as we knew it, our lives, they changed forever. I was in the Navy on that day. I'd flown a late mission the night before. So I kind of drug myself into work that morning. Because I'd gotten home, I don't know, I can remember exactly 2-ish in the morning because I'm flying a late mission. So I got some sleep and was driving in. And when I first started hearing about on the radio, and you just kind of freeze and you stop and you turn the volume up and you're like, what's going on? Is this, is this real? Mm-hmm. And of course, the next day on September 12th, I flew a mission up to the carrier sitting off of Long Island. And the airspace was completely quiet, no radio comms whatsoever. Checked in with New York Center, and it was basically like, Rawhide airspace is yours in New York City.
Wow.
And I could see the smoke coming from Manhattan. And first and only time I ever landed on an aircraft carrier where I could still see land.
Wow.
Because the carrier was that close to Long Island. Mm. And, you remember where you were in those moments and at that time. And then within weeks, it wasn't me personally. I was on a shore tour, but within weeks, carriers were heading east, and the next year we're sending all kinds of folks over to Afghanistan to fight that war, and what was the end result, Andy? The next was 3 decades almost now of a war on terror that's just never really ended, right? And now we're looking at, as we re-optimize for great power competition, we're looking at near peers in China and Russia that want to challenge the world order. They're not satisfied with the world order the way it is. And now, after all of this time fighting this 9/11 world, this war on terror, this world that was created by these attacks on U.S. soil, we're going to have to completely reinvent ourselves as a military and as a country to compete with these great powers and these dictators that aren't comfortable with the idea of U.S. influence in their parts of the world. And it's obviously a really can be scary, can be challenging, can be difficult to comprehend what comes next. But what we do know is that there will be a moment at some point, whether it's next week, next year, in 5 years, that we have another day like 9/11 where our world changes forever. And have we had those conversations with our family? Have we had that introspection with ourselves to ask ourselves, have we truly done everything we could do to prepare for that moment? Basically, you know, essentially putting your affairs in order, right? Mm-hmm. If you're the person in the house that knows how to operate that VCR we talked about, and nobody else does, you maybe ought to teach somebody else how to do that. Does somebody else in your household know where your money's at, how to get to it? And those are the kind of things that we just want to have, instead of ignoring those things and then hoping that they never happen, we can hope that they never happen while still preparing for the very real possibility that they will. And that's just making ourselves as good as we can possibly be at our jobs that the Air Force has asked us to do, whether it be flying or fixing airplanes or working on comm equipment or being a public affairs officer or working in the fire department or civil engineering and all the other things that we have on this base, being the absolute best that we can be and ready to go at a moment's notice, while also simultaneously working on those family care plans. You know that, okay, if I go away tomorrow as the service member, if I leave tomorrow, do we have a plan for what happens with the family? You know, if we talk to the grandparents, if we talk to the extended family and know what we're going to do. Because if someone leaves on short notice, if a maniac leaves on short notice and they haven't had those conversations, I guarantee they're not going to be focused on their job. So that's kind of the thoughts. If you asked what are my thoughts on it, that's why it's so important to me. And that's why I message you every chance I get.
Oh, that's awesome. So you know, generalizing, this answer into like something that my grandmother would understand, I guess, without too many acronyms, what do you think that as a whole that your wing would be ready, whether it's IMR wise or readiness wise, do you think that your wing is ready to go at a moment's notice?
Well, that's a great question. And I think the true answer to that is probably classified.
Yeah, I'm sure.
but I can, I will say this, to me, readiness isn't IMR. It's not, have we done every CBT, computer-based training module that the Air Force has asked us to do? It's readiness for me boils down to mental preparation. Mm. It boils down to, can I do my job? And have I mentally prepared myself and the people in my life and my bubble for that moment? That's it for me, Andy. It really is, because everything else we can teach just in time. We can deploy and we can teach as we go, and we can mentor as we go, and people will learn very, very quickly what has to be done and how to do it. The ingenuity and the creativity of our airmen, that is our secret weapon. That is how we will win in these great power competitions, because it is what we have that the men and women in the services of those countries that are going to be our competitors and our enemies, so to speak, they don't have that. Mm-hmm. They're not empowered to do that. Mm-hmm. They're not given that because they are authoritarian regimes. So when you turn airmen loose, that is our secret weapon.
It's kind of the proverbial, you know, the backbone, the greatest weapon in our military or our Air Force are the airmen and not nuclear weapons, airplanes. Absolutely. It's the airmen.
Yeah, systems come and go. It's about the people and how well we've prepared our people.
So, kind of leading from that point about preparation and readiness and getting our people ready, we have a little thing called the NORI coming up in October.
Stands for a nuclear operational readiness exercise.
Thank you. All right. I didn't want to try and do that and butcher it. And then I don't want Joe to hurt me again. So what could you say, or what can you say about that? What can our folks do to be ready for that and set ourselves up for and our teams up for success come October?
Well, you know, the word nuclear scares a lot of people, right? And me included. I wasn't in the nuclear world most of my military career. I've had a crash course in it the last several years. Had some great academic courses that I went to. And, of course, being here now as commander of the Maniacs, I have to be involved with it a lot more than I've ever had to in the past. But there's a lot of open source information out there. It's a lot of what the nuclear mission really means isn't classified by design. Right. So I'm not going to get into all of it here in the podcast. I would just encourage people to go do some Google research and learn what it means to have a nuclear triad.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the land component, and the sea component, and the air component of the triad as far as nuclear deterrence. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason a lot of it's not classified is because if those people, those other great nuclear powers that have the capability to reach out and touch the continental United States with nuclear weapons, if they don't know what your capabilities are, then you're not going to deter them from any kind of action.
They're going to assume to sail.
Yeah. And all, deterrence is all about capability first, right? And will. It's about will. And that's where it comes in. That's where it comes in with us here at the 101st is demonstrating that will, the willingness to do the mission, the willingness to be good at it, and have the confidence that you know that if called upon, hopefully to deter our enemies in those critical moments from taking that existential action that could result in the elimination of either society, that you have the willingness to stand toe-to-toe and do that. And that's, you know, STRATCOM's motto is peace is our profession. That's the nuclear triad is about maintaining the peace.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people might argue it seems that that's counterintuitive, right? Well, having nuclear weapons and the willingness to use them, how does that in any way ensure peace? That's a great question. I told a group not too long ago about a first cousin once removed of mine. His name is Bruce Blair. He's deceased now. I never got a chance to talk to him in person, but he's my mom's first cousin, my grandmother's favorite son. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, favorite nephew. And, he was actually a pretty big deal in the nuclear community, a nuclear, expert, often called upon to consult, was a missile officer in the United States Air Force, nuclear missile officer for many years early in his career. And he was a co-founder of an organization called Global Zero, whose whole goal in life is the elimination of nuclear weapons from the planet. Very noble goal, right? Mm-hmm. Something mm-hmm. that we all would probably say is a good idea. The counter argument to that, and I'm not taking a position either way, to be honest.
Right.
The counter argument to that within academic circles is the last Hitler has not been born. You cannot uninvent nuclear weapons. Therefore, any effort to eliminate them is only just kind of going to ensure that the only people who do have them are criminals, kind of like the same argument with guns, right? But at the end of the day, if you can't uninvent nuclear weapons, and the last Hitler hasn't been born, then we better maintain a nuclear triad that's capable of deterring any kind of action at the end of the day. And we are part of that on the air side is the refueling. And none of that happens. The air component of the nuclear mission cannot happen without tankers. It's absolutely critical. So that's what the NORI is about. The NORI is about those skills that it takes to get an airplane off the ground in the time required to get to a certain point in space, in the time required to refuel those bombers. And you can't say it any less significantly than that. And that is a whole wing effort. Now, I will say this about the NORI, because people have asked, what's the expectations of the NORI if we're not directly involved with launching of aircraft? And my answer to that is everyone on this wing is involved with the launching of aircraft. Mm-hmm. You may not be directly, you may not feel like you are, but at the end of the day, that's all of our jobs, mm-hmm. right? It's all of our jobs is to fuel the fight and get those airplanes to a particular point in space at a particular time. And just during the NORI, do your jobs, do your regular jobs, do your training, conduct the drill like you would, and seek mission. You know, look for ways to help mm-hmm. and ask how you can contribute. And if the answer is like, we really don't have anything to do for you right now, great. At least you tried.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we'll get through and hopefully learn some things and at the end be better prepared to execute that.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sorry, not to rave on too long about it, Andy, but just the other point I'll make on the NORI is, you know, the exciting part about this NORI is that it is part of a larger nationwide exercise called Global Thunder, that is exercising the entire command and control structure of the nuclear triad. And so we are integrated into a much bigger piece for this October exercise. And I'm going to learn a ton, hopefully. It'll be my first one as the commander. So I'm really in learning mode for this one, and excited to learn what I don't know as we go through this.
I'm assuming that we're going to be generating and all that jazz.
Absolutely. Okay. Yeah. Yep. That's cool. Generating aircraft. You bet.
That's awesome. And did you recently just come back from that? Is it called the Nuke 400?
Yeah. It was one of the classes I took. It was out in New Mexico.
Okay.
Yeah. It was a good course. It was very 2 days course, very strategic minded, commanders of STRATCOM and Global Strike. And it really is just a course designed for leaders who have to manage within the nuclear enterprise. But that's cool. Just where I was able to, you know, learn a lot of what we just talked about. Mm-hmm. Yeah, great course. And not a lot more to say about that.
Yeah, oh, that's awesome. What, you mentioned Colonel Gillis or General Gillis earlier and talking about the family legacy that he's had out here at the wing. So the NORI is not the only big event that we've got coming up. So what's going on?
Other big events on October drill is Sunday afternoon. Actually, Sunday morning it starts, right? Mm-hmm. And back to my point of, hey, you know, this might be a NORI going on, but, you know, we still have other work to do and just get about doing the work. We are actually going to promote Brigadier General Roy to Major General.
That's awesome.
If those may not have heard about that, but it's, yeah, let's face it, everyone's heard about it.
that's how it works, right?
10:30 up in the ops briefing room on that Sunday of drill, which is, what is the actual date?
The 20th. Sunday? I think the only reason why I know that is my moose hunt ends the 19th, which is that Saturday.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah. So on the 20th, we'll be promoting a couple of generals. We'll promote General Roy in the morning. And then at 1400 that afternoon, as the NORI is concluding and wrapping up, we'll all hopefully, everyone who's available, gather in the fuel cell hangar, and we're going to promote Colonel Gillis to General, Brigadier General Gillis. Then we're going to have an award ceremony and recognize some outstanding maniacs. And then we're going to roll right from that little award ceremony into a change of command authority between General Roy and General Gillis. So General Roy will move on to his next assignment, which is going to be as the Air National Guard Assistant to AETC, the Education and Training Command down in San Antonio. And move General Gillis into his role as our boss here in the state of Maine.
Is General Roy going to be physically moving down there, or how's that?
No, I don't. But I said, he does have family down there.
Oh, that's right.
So he'll spend time down there. It's a part-time job. Not a full-time job. It's a part-time job. So they'll bring him in to consult and be involved in certain things as deemed appropriate. But it's not a full-time. Doesn't have to be there every day type of thing.
That's cool. Good for him.
Yeah, outstanding. It's good for Maine, good for him. It's just an acknowledgement of the great work he's been putting in, representing us at the national level. That's as a Brigadier General. Yeah, and the strategic planning system. He's been an active participant in that since putting on One Star.
And so General Gillis will be the new big boss.
Chief of Staff and Commander of the Air National Guard in the state of Maine. Yeah, absolutely.
I got another question for
you. No, let's roll. Keep going.
All right. So you've been doing this. You've been here. You've been the boss. You've been the wing commander for almost a year now. If you had to think about one big takeaway of your experience here as a maniac, what would it be?
Wow. One big takeaway.
Sorry to put you on the spot. I should have emailed this to you.
No. That's okay. I like this. I like this. It's better just to have a conversation than to be too scripted. I just think my big takeaway, Andy, more than anything else, is that there is so much more in this country that unites us than divides us in reality, right? If you look at the current dialogue at the national level in the press, or online, and all this division that gets talked about, especially with an election coming on. So much of that, and I really hope people take this to heart, it is driven by trolls. It's driven by misinformation being spread on the internet intentionally by those who don't love the United States. Our enemies don't care who the president of the United States is. They only care that we as Americans start distrusting our own system and are divided. Our enemies want us divided. But my takeaway, having come from the Midwest, coming from a place where I call Kansas City home, to being the commander of the Maniacs living in Bangor, Maine, it was a huge transition. But what I could tell you this is that there are such good people everywhere. Because human beings are so much more like, all we really want to do is be able to provide for our families and feed our families and be a part of something bigger than ourselves and feel like we have purpose, right? And I don't care what side of the political spectrum you're on. Mm-hmm. I don't care what religion you are. Those basic commonalities that we have as human beings, 99.9% of this population, maybe that's a high number, mm-hmm. but so many of us are alike and connected and have the same goals in life, truly. 5% of your, 5% of the people cause 95% of the problems is a common expression. And I just think that's true. Mm-hmm. It really hasn't been that hard of an adjustment. It's been not a hard adjustment at all because I've just been embraced by mm-hmm. the people here. I've been embraced by the community, embraced by the Maniacs, because there's just so many good people here. And it's been an absolute honor and a privilege to be the commander and to join this organization.
It's been great having you. It's, as you can imagine, like it's like anywhere, like when you hear, oh, that we're going to have a new boss and we don't know him. We don't know what he's like or what his background is. Sometimes, as you can imagine, that could be a little bit scary, cause you, yeah. It's like,
he's from away.
Yeah. He's from away. He's not Colonel Gillis. Like what's going to happen. But, I think that, me personally, what I admire the most about not just you, but the team that we have currently is the structure and like marching orders. And not to say we never had that before, cause we absolutely did. But, at the end of the day, like we're wearing the uniform and marching orders is what I need to operate at my level. Hey, this is our goal. Like, we all play our roles. Like you said earlier, even if we're not touching the aircraft or flying or, part of that NORI directly. I look at it the same way that, we all have our roles to play. And as long as we know where to go and how to get there, or where to go to turn to if we need help, then I think that's really all you can ask for is for that that direction. And I'm sure you feel the same way about your higher ups, you want direction and, it's good to have that. What's something that, we talk about a big message is 5 and 10 year plans. What's something that you'd like to see our next big accomplishment as the wing commander? What would you like to see your wing accomplish?
That's a great question. Obviously the KC-46 looms, but kind of going back to my point about, we don't know what's going to, are we going to keep buying more KC-46s as a country? Are we going to buy something different? Are we going to go, we're going to fly KC-135s out to 2060. Well, those who are still flying the KC-135 means those jets have to be modernized, right? So regardless of what system, what airframe, we're going to be operating 5 years, 10 years, 15 years down the road, infrastructure is critically important, especially in a northern tier like this, and maintaining our infrastructure and keeping it modernized. So a selection as MOB 7 of KC-46 would automatically bring a ton of investment in infrastructure. Mm-hmm. But without that, we have to get after those things on our own, right? So mm-hmm. I think my biggest goal and objective is to just message to the appropriate people the necessity of maintaining the infrastructure here at Bangor because of all the various missions that we support, whether it be the 24/7 alert that we maintain here for Homeland Defense, whether it be our support to Global Strike and to STRATCOM and to TRANSCOM with all of the transient traffic that goes through this base. We have work to do. We are in the process of designing and acquiring money to build a new fuel cell hangar, which will be built to AMC standard so it can accommodate any size aircraft that the Air Force operates, minus the C-5, C-17 and down. And then we got to look at getting our taxiways repaired so that those are viable long-term into the future. And then we got to start tearing down some buildings that aren't really functional anymore and, you know, not maintaining that extra square footage and start consolidating. So I would say my biggest goal, my biggest focus is leaving here with a solid plan for infrastructure investments moving into the future. And then, you know, that's big picture for the base, but, you know, I, from day one, my other goal it was just forced development. You know, coming in here and getting to know the people and getting to know the officer and the enlisted leadership that's in place and those who are poised to come up to the next level. And, you know, a lot of my time is spent just building that plan, working with state leadership and internal 101st leadership to say, okay, here's the plan. Here's how we're going to progress. Here's how we're going to train people, develop people so that, you know, the big part of that is mentorship. Mentorship's a big thing for me, Andy. And so making sure we have a good, solid culture and a good, solid program of developing people and mentoring people for that next level of responsibility is the other thing that I'm focused on.
So, it, you know, you mentioned you just that last thing you just mentioned. So not today, but I think last Thursday, and I'm sorry that I'm butchering what the what I'm about to ask here. But like, I feel like was it last Thursday, did you mention something about you and your team doing some sort of like a like reaching out to newer airmen and younger airmen to find out if they're getting what they need, or am I am completely misremembering that, I'll edit this whole thing out. But I feel like you said something about that, or like.
Well, there's a couple different things we have going on right now that I'm working on in terms of mentorship. The chief and I are bantering back and forth a little bit, a memo that basically gives our philosophy for wing level mentorship. But our philosophy for wing level mentorship really boils down to the squadron. You know, mentorship has to live and breathe at the squadron level for it to be effective, right? Squadron level has to have, you know, that mentoring program and that deliberate assigning of a new member to someone who's going to be able to guide them through their career progression. And so the squadrons have to have strong mentoring programs, and they have to be unique to what that squadron's function is and what their responsibilities are. Mm-hmm. So we don't want to micromanage the squadron level mentorship program, but we just have to put the appropriate level of emphasis on it at the wing level. And so the chief and I are working through that in terms of what our roles are and of making sure that we drive that home. But beyond that, maybe you'd seen the questions I sent out. The DEOC survey doesn't allow us to customize questions.
Okay.
They allow us to choose optional questions.
Maybe that's what I'm thinking of.
But it was a system limitation that I couldn't actually write my own questions. So
that's crazy. Huh.
So when I sent out the email on the DEOC survey to the wing, I included the questions I would have asked had I been able to tailor the questions. And so there were some questions in there that involved really getting after mentorship and whether or not people were getting the training that they needed when they came to drill and along things of those natures.
I think that's exactly what I was thinking of. That's what it was. And I think you mentioned that in stand-up too, that because you made that joke about you'd think being the wing commander, you could tailor the questions a little bit, but you can't, but that's interesting.
Yeah, it's and I always ask the question, is this a system limitation or a policy limitation? Because if it's a policy limitation, we can get around that.
Yeah.
if it's actually a physical system limitation, well, we can get around that, but not tomorrow.
Yeah.
That's a longer fix.
Yeah. That's awesome, sir. Is there anything you'd like to add about anything we talked about here, or?
I don't think so, Andy. I'd love to have this conversation. Anytime you want to chat, I'm always available. I think we should talk about some other folks we should get here behind the mic.
This is the first one in 10 months. So we've been
you've been busy. We've kept you busy. Mm-hmm. Yeah. We kept you busy. I'll ask you a question. It looked like you had somebody on your lap this morning when you were driving into work.
He just kind of jumped over there. He's actually.
It's your puppy, right? What age is he now?
He's 6 months. Five months, something like that.
Looking big already.
He is. And of course, we named him after Major Buck Clevin.
Nice.
That's Bucky.
Yeah,
so,
cause nice.
My wife had actually, she's like, what about Bucky? And I was like the Winter Soldier? And she goes, no, Buck Clevin, because we were watching that show. Actually, at the recommendation of you and one of your stand-ups on Apple TV. He is great. He's good.
But you mentioned Buck Clevin, you know, you mentioned, which of course he was a World War II B-17 pilot and one of the featured characters in the show we talked about the Bloody 100th, Masters of the Air. I just finished another great World War II book. But I'll close this with a comment on two books I keep in my office that within my view because, I'll put this on the podcast and you can do with it what you will. But the two books that I keep there that I reference and I look at, One is called Grant Takes Command by Bruce Canton, which was recommended to me by reading another book by James Mattis, former Secretary of Defense, former Marine Corps general. And the other one is by Joshua Cooper Ramo, and it's called Age of Uncertainty. But there's two things I take away from those books that I use every day in my my, you know, as I think about the best way to lead. And in the Grant book, Grant, there's a passage in there when a subordinate rattles off a bunch of things that they need Grant to make decisions on, and he makes the decision, and then they say, "Are you sure?" And he basically backlashes on him and says, "No." He says, "I'm not sure, but I have to make a decision. We have to make decisions. We cannot be bogged down in indecisiveness. We'll make the decision. We'll move forward. And if it turns out being the wrong decision, we'll correct it. But we cannot wait and not make decisions. We have to make decisions." The other part of the Grant book is the part where Lincoln talks about Grant and says Grant is the only general that never asked him to do impossibilities. Grant never turned to the president and said, "Well, I can't do this unless you do this." Grant always just got the job done and never made excuses and never asked Lincoln to do the impossible. He took it on his personal responsibility, personal accountability, right, to get the job done. And then Joshua Cooper Ramo in The Age of Uncertainty talks about living in chaotic times. And in this world that we're living in right now that just seems so, like some days it just seems like it's spiraling out of control. How do you function? How do you lead in a world that's so chaotic? And that basically when you read and you boil it right down to his recommendations are you have to let go of control in order to have control, which means you got to trust your people.
Mm-hmm.
You got to just
not micromanage.
You just have to let people go and trust that they're going to be creative and that they're going to do the right thing. That's, you know, in a chaotic world where you never know what's around the next corner, and you have to make decisions at the speed of now. If you don't trust your people and you don't empower them to make decisions and get after the mission, you're going to fail because the old paradigm, the old models just don't work anymore because information flows too fast and events happen too quickly. That the only productive teams are the teams that just go, right? And so those two things kind of relate a little bit, you know, going back to the Civil War with Grant and then now in the modern world of the speed of information is you know, take the information you have, make decisions, and just go. And that's what I'm asking the 101st to do is just go, baby.
Those words to live by. That's awesome, sir. I appreciate it. Thank you for your time. And everybody, this is Colonel Newell's debut podcast, and hopefully many more to come, and we'll get this on a regular basis.
Awesome. Look forward to it, Andy. Thanks.
Thanks, sir. Thank you, Colonel Newell, for taking the time to talk with us. The wing has a lot on the horizon. Let's get through it together. Man, that was corny. Speaking of corny, as in candy corn, Halloween is just around the corner. So for the love of everything headless, please stay safe and keep those around you safe. Trust me, we don't want to be another statistic for Dominic's Thursday morning stand-up spiel. Seriously though, that guy rattles numbers off so fast sometimes, it's hard to keep up. I'd like to be inside his head for a day. Yeah, maybe not though. He did come from the fuel cell. But I hope you all have a good October drill and safe Halloween. Dig out those blaze orange hats. Put them on your dashboard. Not only do they keep you visible and safe, but they also tell everyone on the road that you're really, really cool, even if you don't hunt. Take care of yourselves and take care of each other. And like Miss Piggy's second cousin used to say, that's all, folks.